My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic.
You sure are.
And I'd like to thank Rick and the members of the committee for the privilege of coming up here and sharing with you. You guys don't know how great, how lucky you are this morning that Bob Fisher didn't sing. I've known Bob for a number of years, and we've gone some places together. I remember one time we went to Disneyland, and we're in line, and he breaks out at the top of his lungs with a show tune. I mean, and I'm trying to get away from him. You know, it's like everybody's looking at us, but that's Bob. I'd like to welcome anybody that's reasonably new. I'm real glad you're here. I hope you connect with something here that will bring you back to Alcoholics Anonymous and eventually set you on fire with the program Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people here in this room that I know and I've known for a long time. Matter of fact, there's some people here. I don't know why you're here. There's some people in this room that have heard me talk 10, 15 times. I got to tell you, if I didn't have to be here to listen to me, I wouldn't. I don't know why you're here. If you're new, I know what it's like to be a newcomer. I was a professional newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous for about 7 years, and I didn't like it. It was always a low point in my life. It was always a time when I didn't feel very good about myself. It was always a time when I felt very ashamed of myself, and I would end up in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and everybody would want me to stand up and be recognized. You know, and it was a very awkward thing for me, but I'm glad you're here. And I'm glad you're here because if you're here, you have a shot at connecting with something that will change your life so dramatically the far stretches of your imagination can't reach that far. I'll tell you a little story about me. I think I was about 3 or 4 years old, and I lived back in Pennsylvania, and it was a Sunday afternoon, and I went with my folks to a farmer's market that they have outside of town where all the farmers bring in their wares. And on the way out there, my dad is telling my mom about this one farmer who has this type of horseradish that's won all these awards. It's real strong, real potent horseradish. And he's excited about going and getting some of this. My dad liked that kind of stuff. The hotter, spicier, the better. And we're going into this farmer's market, and he's getting some of this horseradish. And I'm a little kid. I don't know what he's got, but I said, can I have some? And never forget this. He looked at me, said, no. He said, son, this is strong. This is for grown-ups. You can't have any of this stuff. Well, I think I've always been the type of person, if you tell me I can't have something, I may not really want it until you tell me I can't have it, then I really get interested. And we went home, and I bid my time, and a little time went by, and my folks were visiting with the neighbors, and I snuck in the refrigerator, opened that door, I got that jar of horseradish out, got a big spoon, sat on that kitchen floor with that jar of horseradish between my legs, took that lid off, stuck that spoon in there, put that in my mouth. Now, this was before LSD. But I saw some shit that day, I'll tell you. I had snot pouring out of my nose and tears running down my eyes. I got so sick, I spewed horseradish all over that kitchen. I threw that jar down. I was so miserable and so sick. And I got to tell you, that was over 40 years ago, and I have not once sat with a jar of horseradish and a spoon, and I didn't have to go to no goddamn meetings, get no sponsor work, no steps, or go to no treatment program. But I got to tell you that if that horseradish would have made me feel the way that alcohol made me feel, I'd have spent the next 40 years making myself sick with that stuff every chance I could get. And I am one who believes that I was born an alcoholic. I think I was an alcoholic from the very beginning, even far before I ever took my first drink, because the book says we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows, and that's always been true for me. I was like a freeze-dried alcoholic waiting for alcohol. And I believe that because there was always something wrong with me. I always had this feeling like I didn't fit. No one in my family, no one in my neighborhood, no one in school seem to look the way I felt. There always seemed to be something missing from me. I remember holidays with going over to my grandparents' house and sitting with my uncles and aunts and cousins, and there'd be about 20 of us at this long table, and I'm in the bosom of my family, and I didn't come from an alcoholic family. The people that were sitting at that table were all on my side. And I got to tell you, they all loved me. I can see that looking back, but I could also tell you I could never feel it. That there was something wrong with me where I felt disconnected. And I would sit at that table, and I just couldn't wait to get away from there and go play with all by myself with some little soldiers or something, you know. And I remember the first time I ever took a drink, I was about 12 years old. And I started drinking socially, and I was a social drinker for 15, 20 seconds. Because when I took my first drink of alcohol, alcohol did something for me that I had secretly hungered to have done all my life and didn't even really realize it. When I took that first drink, I was hanging around with a bunch of guys who were older than me, and I'm doing everything I can to fit with them, and I always feel like I'm coming from behind. I never feel enough. And I took that hit off that quart of Seagram 7, and for the first time in my life, I didn't have to pretend anymore. For the first time in my life, I really was one of the guys. For the first time in my life, I felt like they looked. And alcohol did an amazing thing for me. It externalized me, a guy that was always kind of locked up inside himself and never fit in this world. And it brought me out here to where life was going on as an active feeling participant. And all of a sudden, I was really with them. I was a part of, I was connected, I was hooked up. It was a wonderful thing. But I'm the guy they talk about in the big book. And I've been that guy since they picked up my first drink. Dr. Silkworth says it better than anybody I ever heard. He says that guys like me, we have a physical allergy to alcohol. And unlike other allergies, when I drink, I don't break out in hives. I break out in what Silkworth calls a phenomenon of craving. And I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started coming here in about 1971, and I didn't get sober till 78. And in the years I was in and out, I'd hear people talk about phenomenon of craving. And I'd sit there and try to look inside myself and think, do I got this phenomenon of craving? No, I get drunk and I get DUIs and I'm in trouble, but I just drink that way. I mean, my friends drink that way. I mean, it's normal for me to drink that way. It's not a, I saw the Days of Wine and Roses and, you know, those movies, and I didn't drink and claw the walls for a drink. I get drunk, but I mean, that's part of the deal. And the interesting thing about a craving is you don't realize you have it until it's interrupted. That's why the test in the big book, there's a test in there. Now, I don't recommend this test. Some of you guys wouldn't survive it. But there's a test in the book. It says if you don't think you're an alcoholic, go to the nearest bar. Try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. And I'd never done that. Matter of fact, I was the kind of alcoholic, I intuitively knew not to pick up the first drink if I couldn't drink until forever. If I went to your house and you had a six-pack of beer and we were going to be there all day and you offered me a beer, I'm going to pass. Now, if you got a half gallon of vodka and two cases of beer, I'm with you. But I wouldn't do that to myself. And I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard this woman share a story of something that had happened to her, and the light bulb went on inside of me. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous for a guy like me who is absolutely incapable of looking at myself honestly because I'm too defended is that in AA, nobody ever tried to tell me anything about me. What happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you tell me about you, and while you're telling me about you, I don't have my defense mechanisms in play. I'm not trying to defend myself from anything you're trying to tell me about me. And I'm listening to you talk about you. And when you're talking about you, I find myself in rooms going, wow, I did that. I'm like that. Whereas if you would have come up to me and tried to tell me I was like that, oh, I'm not, boy, I can tell you why I'm not like that too. And I'm sitting in this meeting, I'm listening to a woman share her experience, my defense mechanisms are down, I'm just listening to her talk about her. And a light went on, and I remembered something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. When I was 18 years old, I was dating a gal, and she asked me to come home and meet her family and have dinner. It was one of those long all-night ordeals. Now, I'm 18 years old. There was no way in my mind I was an alcoholic. I was in my hippie stage, that better living through chemistry stage of alcoholism, right? And I would have bet anything I'm not an alcoholic. But alcoholism doesn't care what you think. And I went to her house for dinner, and they had a bottle of wine with dinner. And I always drank quickly. I don't know why. Evaporation may be a childhood issue of mine or something. I don't know. But because I drink quickly, I got two glasses out of that bottle of wine and finished them. They're still sipping on their first glass. And I got two glasses of wine in me. I don't know anything about alcoholism. I don't know anything about phenomenon of craving. I don't know anything about anything. I'm sitting there with two glasses of wine in me. I'm starting to get a little antsy. And I finally said, "Boy, that's really good wine. You got any more of that?" And they said, "No." And they went back to talking. And I'm sitting there, and I'm there for the rest of the evening. And I'm starting to get a little uncomfortable. And I don't know what's going on. I blurted out, "You know, I sure like beer." And they, "Well, that's nice, Bob. We don't have any beer." And they went back to talking about Vietnam and sports and all this other stuff. And I'm sitting there, and my head is getting busy. I mean, it is just going so fast, I can't think straight. I'm getting real uncomfortable. I want to shout at them to shut up because they're talking about all this nonsense, and then I feel guilty for even thinking that because they're such nice people, you know, and I'm going, this whirlwind's going on in my head. And I finally excused myself. I didn't know what to do. I was going crazy. I went to the bathroom, and I locked the door, and like a maniac, I went through all the cabinets in there, and I found this bottle of cough medicine. It was like 35% alcohol with codeine and turpinhydrate. And I sat down on the edge of the bathtub, and I, like a crazed maniac, I chugged this bottle of cough medicine. I remember taking the first hit off of it, and it was like, there's hope. I chugged this bottle of cough medicine, and I sat there, and I could think. You know, I could think. I got real focused, and I came up with a game plan, and I went back out to that dinner table, and I explained to them about this thing I had forgotten to take care of, and I was so gracious, and they were so nice about it. They said, "Well, you must come back and do this again." "Yes, I must. This was really wonderful. I hate to leave." "Yeah, yeah, yeah." I got in my car, drove like a gentleman, 25 miles an hour down to the end of their street, and then I drove about 90 miles an hour through a suburban area to get to a friend of mine's house who had a bar in the basement because I had two glasses of wine. Now, I was the only alcoholic at that dinner table. As other people had been alcoholics, we'd all been in that goddamn bathroom looking through those cabinets, right? But something happens to me when I drink that doesn't happen to normal people. And we are really, you know, we think we're in the majority, but we're really in the minority. I part of the business I'm in, a big part of the business is deals with alcohol. And I'll tell you, one of the things I've observed over the years is most people don't drink like I did. Most people will never drink like I did. Most people are astounded by the way people like me drink. You know, they don't understand it. But I secretly thought that I had that phenomenon of craving after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I could finally see that. But I thought that everybody had it. It's for some peculiar reason, normal people or non-alcoholic people had that power of will to control it. Or for some reason they could keep it under wraps. And then there were guys like me that just for some reason seemed not to be able to. I thought that everybody who ever picked up a drink got that feeling of more. And Silkworth, in the doctor's opinion, says that's not true. He says that phenomenon of craving is what differentiates us and sets us apart as a distinct entity. And I didn't really realize that until I was about a little over 4 years sober. And I'm working in this place here called Wonder World, and I met a gal there that worked there, and we started dating for a little bit. She's not an alcoholic, and we'd go out to dinner, and she'd order a drink, and I swear to God, it would take her a half hour to drink one drink. I mean, like she'd stir it, sip, talk for 10 minutes, take another sip. The ice would melt. I mean, that's like alcohol abuse. You know what I mean? The whole time I knew her, I never saw her finish two drinks. Never. I'd see her order a second drink quite often. She'd drink a half of it, two-thirds of it, a quarter of it, and she'd push it aside, and she'd say the most bizarre thing you've ever heard. She'd say, "I don't want any more, I'm starting to feel it." It would be easier for me as an alcoholic to have sex and after two strokes say, "I don't want any more of that, I'm starting to feel it," than it would be to do that with two drinks of alcohol. And I started to realize that I really am different from those people. See, my friend, when she pushed the drink aside, she wasn't trying to prove a point. See, we're all capable of that. Matter of fact, a lot of us have done that. We're with our significant other, and they're on our back about drinking, and so we'll go out to dinner, and we'll show them. We'll have two and stop. We can do that. We can't do it every day. We can do it once or twice. Or we'll go out to lunch with our boss, and he's been on our back about our drinking, and we just have two to show him. See, there's no problem here. But see, my friend wasn't trying to prove a point. When she took two drinks of alcohol, she got a feeling like she was losing control. I take two drinks of alcohol, I get a feeling like I'm getting control. It does something for me that it doesn't do for them. And they will never understand why I drink the way I drink. And you know something? I don't think I'll ever understand why they drink the way they do. I mean, now, why not have a Coke? You know, I mean, why have one and a half drinks? There's that line in the book. It says that science, there's no cure for alcoholism except abstinence. That science may one day find a cure, but hasn't done one, hasn't come up with one yet. Well, it never will, because it's against our nature to even take a cure like that. First of all, if they had a pill that would make that we could take and drink socially, the first thing that would occur to me is, well, what would five of those pills do? I mean, right? And who in this room would want to have two drinks and go home and cut the grass? I mean, really. So people who think that they're going to cure alcoholism, they just don't get it. I mean, they don't get it. They'll never get it. So I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I started coming here in 1971. I was forced to come here. I was in an institution, and the people that had the keys in their pocket thought it was a good idea for me to go to these AA meetings, and I started going to these meetings. And I got to tell you, I was a young kid. I think I was about 20 years old. First thing I noticed is that everybody in AA was old. I mean, there was people here 35 years old. Their life was over. I mean, I knew why they didn't drink, but I'm a young guy. There's a leak here somewhere. I'm a young guy. I think got my life ahead of me, and partying still. It's, you know, alcoholism is a disease of diminishing returns. Yes, I started out drinking, and the fun and the effect was phenomenal. It was way up here. There were some problems, and as the years went on, the problems increased, and the fun and the effect diminished. And by the time I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I was having a lot of problems, but there was still some remnants of effect and fun there. And there was still the illusion of the good times. And I remember sitting in this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't want to be there. I'm too young. You guys talked about God, which made me absolutely crazy. I mean, I was raised with a lot of religious upbringing, you know, and by the time I'm 12 years old, I've made a definite decision that there cannot be a God. I mean, I was taught about a God who existed to judge me. He had these lists of rules of things I'm not supposed to do and these things I'm supposed to do, and if I was even good enough not to do them, if I just thought about doing them, I'm screwed, right? And I'm one of those kind of kids, I just think stuff. You know, I remember the nuns would tell me, "You got to be pure of thought, word, and deed," and they'd say that in X-rated movies. It just start going through my head. You know, God could see in the dark. That is not good for a guy like me. That's a bad deal. He could read my mind. So I remember one nun telling me one time about, I guess she knew that I just was kind of an oddball and didn't fit. I was always in trouble, you know. I don't mean to be in trouble. I'm just in trouble all the time. And she was telling me about a place for God created for guys like me that it's always out of line. It's instead of going to hell where they burn you and torture you forever and ever, God created this place called purgatory, and it's like being in Al-Anon forever. I mean, no. It's, oh, I didn't say that really. See, I'm still weird. That stuff just comes out of me. Anyway, but this place called purgatory, and in purgatory, it's kind of like hell, except they burn you and torture you, but only lasts for a couple hundred million years, you know? And I don't want to offend anybody. I hope this doesn't offend anybody. But I remember discovering masturbation, and I could picture this meter in heaven clicking off the millions of years, right? And I haven't even done anything yet. I'm just practicing. So I get to, so I'm sitting alcoholics, and people are talking about God, and I just get real uncomfortable, and I get real guilty and real nervous, and I just shut you out. I can remember listening to speakers, and I would identify with some of the things that they would say, and then they would talk about God, and I just would discount everything they say. I'd say, oh. I remember this one guy, he was doing life imprisonment in prison. And he was in a trustees group, and he came into this institution I was in with a bunch of trustees to put on an AA meeting. And I'd never seen anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous like this. And I'd been in and out by this time a couple years. This guy had really long hair. He had a beard. He had tattoos. I mean, a big biker guy. I mean, he was in there for murder. And he's telling his story, and I'm listening. It's a great story. And I thought, he's the first guy I ever listened to. I thought, yeah, I'd drink with him. Yeah, man, this guy, he's a man's kind of man. And then all of a sudden he talked about God in his life. And I thought to myself, oh, what have they done to him? You know, I know what happened to him. I knew a guy like that. You do too much drugs, you drink too much, and you end up in the airport with chanting Hare Krishna with a starter rope out the back of your head or something, you know? Or you end up on the corner as a sunbeam for Jesus, you know, giving out Bibles. I mean, you know, we all know, you know, they go too far, a bottle of wine too many, something goes in the brain, you know, and they just, right? So I'm sitting in this meeting, and people talk about God, so I shut the door, I don't listen to that. And then there was one thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think this, I'd really like to talk about this, because if you're new, maybe this is really hitting you. I would stop drinking, and I would come into AA meetings, and I would sit there, and I would listen, and I would observe, and it would become very apparent to me that there must be something else wrong with me than what's wrong with you. Because what I observed in Alcoholics Anonymous is I observed people who quit drinking, and they became happy. They quit drinking and they were grateful for everything. They quit drinking and they had interesting, productive lives. I mean, they would just, great things would happen to them. They had wonderful relationships with people. Their families were in love with them. I mean, they just, wonderful things had happened. And I sit in the meeting and I've quit drinking and I feel awful. I don't feel like you look. I don't feel like you sound. Matter of fact, abstinence to me feels like I'm doing time. And I sit there and I look at you guys and I don't know what's wrong with you, but it's not the same thing that's wrong with me. And if you're new, please hear this, that for out of my experience, my alcoholism always started where the bottle ended. And it was the emptiness of abstinence that would drive me absolutely insane. I'll tell you how insane it would drive me. After three or four rehabs, after knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt that to pick up a drink meant to destroy me, the emptiness of abstinence would drive me so insane I would pick it up knowing that. And I would pick it up because I just couldn't stand the way I felt, and I will do anything to change the way I feel.
I would just get it up to here with abstinence. A feeling would sometimes would come over me that if I don't do something to change this emptiness, this boring, useless feeling inside of me, I'm going to lose my mind. And it's not that I wanted to destroy myself or be violated or be homeless again or any of that stuff. I just needed some relief from this thing I've come to understand is alcoholism. And I would pick up a drink and the phenomenon of craving would kick in and I would just go through the deal again and I'd end up smashed down one more time and either in a county jail or on the streets or in some detox or where. I've never been able to stop drinking. When I pick up a drink, I have to be stopped. I have to be stopped by being arrested, running out of money, getting thrown out somewhere, being cut off, passing out. I have never once in my life been in a bar and the bartender's coming around and asked me if I want another drink and I said to him, you know, this is just right. This is just, no, I don't need another drink. This is fine. I like this, just like this. I have never known that experience. When I started drinking, alcohol opened a black hole in me that I could never fill. I never fill. And I had to be stopped. And I would be stopped and I'd crawl into another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous feeling awful. And I would sit there and I would listen to how grateful everybody was and I'd listen to how great their lives were and I'd sit there and just die. I know what it's like to die of untreated alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know what it's like to sit in the room and have nowhere else to go and know that this can't be it either. Because here I'm sitting, I'm 2-3 months sober, I'm going to your meetings, and I don't feel like you look. I don't feel good at all. I'm hanging on by my fingernails. I can't stand this. And I thought I was part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was part of the passing parade that goes through Alcoholics Anonymous on its way to the graveyard. And I'll tell you what happened to me in 1978. The end of 77, I'd been arrested for a felony DUI and a stolen car. I went before a judge after a couple months in the county jail because I was destitute and homeless and nobody would do my bail. The judge, after reading the probation and parole report, sentenced me to 2 years in the state prison. And he did something that was kind of unusual, even though I've met people in Alcoholics Anonymous had the same experience since then. He stayed the commitment. He said, I've committed you to 2 years in the state prison. He said, but through the probation and parole department, we found this place that'll take you for a year. And if you'll go into this place for a year and you get good UAs and a good PNP report and you make the restitution and you do everything you're supposed to do, at the end of that year, or approximately this date, you'll come back before me and you may or may not have to do the 2 years, or you may, if you don't fulfill those requirements. So I went into this, I can't even call it a treatment center. It was like a mission, kind of. It was a skid row place that just housed homeless, dying winos. And I went into this place, and I'm determined with everything in me not to drink. Determined. For two reasons. One is I don't want to do the 2 years in prison. I've been in jail. I don't like jail. I don't jail well. Some people jail well. I don't jail well. I don't like it. I still got scars from beefs I got in county jails with people. And winter's coming on, and I don't have a place to live, and I had friends that would freeze to death on the streets. You know, if you're homeless and it's wintertime back east and it's 10 degrees out, you've got to walk all night long. I mean, you've got to walk. You can't even sit down, because you sit down, you fall asleep, you're dead. So you walk all night long. You look for doorways or places at bus stations until you get rousted out of there, and you got to... I didn't want to do that again. So I'm in this place and I'm determined not to drink and I'm hanging on with my fingernails. I'm just, and the time's going in. It's like I'm not drinking day in, day out, week in, week out, month in, month out. You know, it's like, help me. And I'm getting to that point where I can't, I'm getting ready to drink again, no matter what the consequences. It's coming. I can see it coming at me, man. I've been down this road before. And I'm scared. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this no more. There's no more fun in drinking for me. And out in a moment of desperation, out of after an in-house meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I grabbed this old timer and, hey, this guy's sober. Year and a half at least. I mean, I grabbed this guy and I asked for help. I'd never done that before. I asked him, you gotta help me. And I started telling him everything that was going on inside of me and everything that was happening to me. And I told him about facing the 2 years in prison. I told him about the homelessness, and I was afraid of being out in the streets, and I'm afraid of drinking. And I even opened up and told him about some of the things that were going on inside of me. Emotionally, there was something wrong with me. And I didn't know if I needed therapy. I'd been to a lot of therapy. It didn't seem to help. But I was the kind of guy, I could be sitting in the TV room in the joint I'm living in, and I could feel wonderful, like I could conquer the world. And 2 minutes later, I'm almost suicidally depressed, and nobody's even said nothing to me. You know, I just go on these roller coaster rides that were just, they're just wacko. And my head was just nuts. I think stuff all the time. I'm always, everything from dying of terminal diseases in my mind to just all kinds of crazy stuff. Living with my head in early sobriety is kind of like driving cross country in a van full of 8-year-olds that have overdosed on sugar and none of them like you. It's all these little voices in my head just, you know, it's all a lot of what ifs. What if, Bob? What if? What if? What if? What if? And I look around, hey, nobody, everybody else is just serene. I'm afraid I'm going to drink. I don't know what's wrong with me. And I said to this guy, I told him all this stuff. And I can't work. There's something wrong with me. I can't, I can get a job. I just can't hold a job. I'm not a team player sober. They always come up to me and I heard this all my life. People would come up to me and say, Bob, you're a hard worker, but there's just something about your attitude. It's like, what? What? What's about my attitude? You know, I can't hold a job, and I get on the muscle around people. I don't mean to, but I get uptight, and I just kind of stay away from me around people, and I get all this anger and fear going on. I don't know that. I just know that I don't fit well sober. Now, you give me 5 shots of Jack Daniels, and I could be a crew leader. I mean, you know. But sober, I just kind of hang my head and just kind of, I go from being depressed and withdrawn to being assertive and obnoxious. There's no in-between for me. And I'm telling this guy all this stuff, and I said, I need help, man. I'm going to drink. I don't want to drink no more. And in the room where we were sitting on the wall was the thing with the 12 steps. And he points up to there and he says, well, Bob, he says, we have these 12 steps. He said, if you'll put those in, if you'll do those, this will solve these things. So this was your answer. And I'm desperate. And I thought, I'd seen those steps over the years in AA. A lot of times I thought to myself, I better really read them this time. And I sat there and I read them, and it became real clear to me this guy hadn't heard anything I had just told him. I mean, there's nothing, there is absolutely nothing on this board that relate. I mean, it's not that I have anything against what's on that board. There's nothing on that board that relates to anything I just told him. It's like, I need a set of steps. Like, step one, make Bob's police record disappear. Step two, make his family realize how wrong they'd been about him. Step three, give him $1,000. Step four, bring her back, properly ashamed of herself. Step five, let him sleep and have some peace in his life. Have a step that would make me feel better. But no, we got my personal favorite. Turn your will and your life over to the care of God. I could see how there were people in Alcoholics Anonymous that could do that. I mean, you guys were nice people. You did. I mean, you don't know where I done some stuff that I'd never to this day heard people, anybody in AA say they did. I mean, when you live on the streets and you live like I did, I mean, it's a, jeez, I'd rather turn to God. To God? The guy with the book? I mean, the guy that sees in the dark? You want to turn? I'd rather turn my life over to a narcotics agent. To God, get out of here. And then my real, another favorite, make amends. Oh, that's, I love that. You guys can make amends. I'm sure you said something nasty to your wife one night. You need to make an apology. You might have even skimped on the, you might have even cheated on your expense account at the office. You should make amends. Yes, you should. I did stuff. Woo! I was the kind of guy that you ran into me in the park and you felt sorry for me and you took me home and you said I could sleep on your couch. When you went to work, I robbed you. And it wasn't nothing personal, believe me. I faced going to prison at one time. I was going to do 10 years, and to save my own butt, I turned in all these guys, you know? I could just picture myself sober, making amends, going up to the head of an outlaw motorcycle gang that just got out of 10 years in prison, say, "Well, Cheech, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sorry I turned you in. I'm sorry you had to do the 10 years, but I'm sober. I know you'll forgive me." I'd rather put a gun to my mouth, right? So I'm looking at these steps, and it's like, come on. I can't, there's nothing there that's for me. And you know, if you're new, I hope you hear this. I go on a run. Alcohol wipes me out, cleans my clock, takes everything away from me. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing I get back is my goddamn opinion. And it's my opinion and my judgment that keeps me from doing all this stuff. People in AA would tell me stuff for years. Get involved. Get a home group. Get a sponsor. I got a sponsor one time because I thought he could get me a good job. Had me selling Amway. I mean, stuff in AA. I never did it. I never got involved. I could never stuck my hand out to anybody. I'd go to the meetings and sit in the back of the room and just judge. I'd do that well. And so I walked away from that guy, and I went on my last drunk, and I went on the run, hitchhiking cross country in 1978. I ended up here in Las Vegas. And I ended up in the hospital here. I was real sick. And I always got to a point where I would desperately need a drink, but I couldn't hold one down. And it would get real scary, and that was the time I always have to go to the hospital. I'd get to a point where no matter how much stuff I'd throw up and try to drink, I couldn't get enough down to get well. And I'd had in the past DTs and seizures and stuff, so I had to check into this county hospital. And normal people never understand some of the things we go through to drink. I remember one time I was about 2 years after I found the morning drink. And when you get to that point, the morning drink is medicine. I mean, this is not drinking. This is medicine. And I would come to, and I'd be flying apart. I used to come to and rock. I'd grab myself and rock back and forth like I'm going to fly apart. And this one, and I had the dry heaves, bad, bad. And getting that first drink down to get well was a struggle. Normal people wouldn't understand this. And I remember one time I came to and I had about this much wine left in a bottle of wine. And I'm going to get well. But I know how I am, and I'm going to throw it up. It's not that we don't have willpower. I tell you, I made up my mind. I'm going to pour that down there. Because if I get that down, it'll make me steady enough that I can go out and hustle. So I'm determined. And I pour that wine down in me, and it's starting to come up. And I clench my jaw. And I'm not going to throw that stuff up no matter what. And it came out my nose. And I must have been eating chili in a bar somewhere the night before. I mean, So I'm at a point where I go into this hospital because I'm real sick, and I'm just whooped. And something had changed inside of me, and I'd go to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in that hospital, and I'd hear guys like Dick and some of the people from my home group that used to bring meetings in there. And it seemed to me like they were talking about a different type of Alcoholics Anonymous that I heard about when I was in Pennsylvania. But what I think really happened is that I think the view changes from the bottom.
And all of a sudden, I could hear things I could never hear before. And I'm sure that they must have been said somewhere in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I was in before, but I could just never listen. I was too busy defending myself. And I started to identify, and the Buddhists say that when the student's ready, the teachers appear. And the people that brought that meeting in there were real doers in Alcoholics Anonymous. They were real active people. They were involved in everything in Alcoholics Anonymous in this part of the state. If there was a committee going on somewhere, or this convention or anything, those people were involved. They were the people that did most of the 12-step work and the hospital and institution work in Southern Nevada. And I joined their group, and I got a sponsor, and I started following them around. And I started listening to the things that people in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, and I started actually doing some of this stuff. And the most amazing thing happened is the actions I started to take started to change my life. I went through a stage in early sobriety, first couple years, where my sponsor was on this kick. He had me reading page 60 through 63 of the Big Book all the time. This is probably an exaggeration. It seemed like I read it 1,000 times. I don't know. But every time I talked to him, he said, "Have you read page 60? Yeah, okay." And I'd read that. I'd open the book, and some of you guys have read it. It's about the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery. It's about selfishness, self-centeredness. And I'd read that, and I'd go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could see how you guys were doing that stuff. I could see how you had just big egos, running the show, trying to control very self-centered people in AA. And I knew why he told me to read that, so I could enlighten you, straighten you out. And I'll tell you, it's a tough, lonely business when you know how everybody is and how they should be, and you're just dying to tell them. It's a tough, tough deal. And there's a line in the 12x12, and I didn't see this for years later. It says that we are always able to see our defects of character in others before we can see them in ourselves. And that's what was going on in me. I could see that you were self-centered. I could see that you were sometimes like the actor who wants to run the whole show, but I couldn't see how I was like that. And I'll tell you what happened to me. One day, I was having a bad day. And it's the kind of bad day that guys like me in early sobriety have. It's nothing major. It's all the little stuff. I'm working as a cashier in this store, and the customers are just bothering me. I mean, they all want attention. They're all just real demanding, you know. I'm just building up steam like a pressure cooker that's just building up steam. I get off work, and I got to run by and get some stuff at the store, and I'm a secretary of a meeting that meets at one of the clubs here, and I've got to run over there, and I got a new guy that's going to meet me at that meeting. And I'm in a hurry. I'm always in a hurry in early sobriety, just rushing, a sense of urgency all the time. And I go to the grocery store, and I feel like I'm late, and there's some woman, and I'm in the 9 items or less line, and there's a woman in front of me with 12 items, you know, and I'm in my mind, I'm committing murder, you know, and I'm not doing anything. I'm just building up steam like I want to explode. I get out of there. I'm driving across town to the meeting, and there's somebody in front of me going 5 miles below the speed limit, and my head's telling me, run them off the road, run them off. You know, I don't do nothing. I get to the meeting. I sit my newcomer in a chair where he can hear the message, just the right chair. I wait for the right people to come in. I pick the chairman and the co-chairman of the meeting. I even tell them, I said, we're not going to read chapter 5 tonight. We're going to read chapter 3. We got a new guy here. They said, oh, yeah, okay, whatever. I got it all set up so my newcomer can hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could kind of picture him taking his one-year cake, thanking me, you know. So the chairman starts the meeting. They read chapter 3. He says, does anybody have a subject? Some guy in the room raises his hand. He starts talking about shooting heroin. Somebody else interrupts him and says, you can't, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't talk about that here. Somebody else says, wait a minute, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, you can't tell anybody what to talk about. Somebody else, it was like the meeting from hell. It was, if you've ever been to a meeting like that, I hate meetings like it. It's all this controversy and debate across and crosstalk, and everybody's getting uptight, and I'm getting crazy because my newcomer's not hearing a message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's becoming real clear to me that I'm the only one in AA that really cares about these new people. I'm fed up. By the end of the meeting, I'm quitting AA. I throw the stuff in the bag, swarm out of the meeting, made some snide remark to some old timer, which is, if you're always going to quit AA, you got to give a snide remark to some old timer. I get home and, like Pavlov's dog, I call my sponsor, like, you know. And I'm rambling on about how people are out to get me, like I always do. I'm a good whiner, you know. And he says, read page 60 through 63 of the big book. And I go and I open the book and it's, oh, shit. It's not Billy that's running the show. It's not you guys. I could see for the first time in my life what my problem was. I'm the guy they talk about in that part of the book. And I got to tell you, that was such a change in my life. When I could see myself in that part of the book, for the first time in my life, I got a glimpse of what is the nature of my alcoholism once you take away the alcohol, of the thing that always drives me back to drinking. And I could see for the first time in my life that I'm the actor who wants to run the whole show. I sit in judgment. I sit in meetings and I sit at work and I sit in traffic and I sit in the grocery store and I sit wherever I were. I sit on a throne of judgment. And I look down on everybody else and I know how everybody else should be. I used to go, I remember one time in early sobriety, I had a list of people I was all pissed off at in AA and people at work. And I went to my sponsor with this and I'm saying, this guy's cheating on his wife and this guy's got a big ego and this guy's this. And Dick says to me, he says, you got to quit playing God. Playing God? I'm reporting accurate information here. I'm not playing God. What are you talking about? I couldn't see it. I'm playing God. I'm sitting on this throne of judgment. As if the implication is that I know what's good for everybody. Right? And I got to tell you, I think, over the years, I believe this with everything in me. I think alcoholism, the ISM, the ism, this is a disease of separation. I separate myself. And I do it through my judgment. And I have watched people in Alcoholics Anonymous judge themselves right out of AA before they even leave the rooms. And it's an easy thing to do. I have that type of peculiar ego deformity inside of me. And I catch myself doing it all the time. You know, you sit in meetings and somebody, you know, the chairman calls on somebody and says, oh, don't call on Mr. Gratitude. Oh, no. Or you sit there and, God, look at her. Oh, she's trolling. I see, if he tells us about his new car, I'm going to punch him, you know? And you just sit, and after a while, if you got a head like mine, you don't listen to anybody in the meeting except you, right? And I've just judged my way right out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to see what the nature of this thing was, and it's the thing that always separates me from you guys. I've taken that third step. I take it a lot of times. I take it with new guys. I took it with old timers. In my early sobriety, but I got to tell you, I don't think I really understood what the third step was about for a long time. I know in early sobriety, when I got down on my knees the first time and I took that step, and I said to my father, I said, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and to do with me as thou will. I think God took that more serious than I did, because he started doing with me and building with me, and I got to tell you, I didn't like any of it. It was scary stuff. I was working at, when I did, about the time right after I did that, I was working in this treatment center for teenagers. I lost that job. I could not get another job. My first relationship ended. My roommate moved out. I couldn't afford the apartment. My car broke down. And at the same time, I'm started going through emotional shifts that I didn't understand. I'd be sitting at home drinking a cup of coffee. Just start sobbing. Don't know why. Don't know where it's coming from. Stuff starts coming out of me. And God was building with me and doing with me. And I guess I was like an old abandoned house that it had to be rehabbed. You have to tear a lot of crap out before you can rehab that house. And God started doing that, and some of it was frightening. And I guess maybe when I took the third step the first time, I didn't really know what I was doing. I thought I did. What I was really wanted to do is I didn't want to drink no more. And essentially what I'm saying to my father is I'm saying, God, I offer myself to thee to do with me and build with me as thou will. I'm really saying, God, I want to try to make my life none of my business. And how can a self-obsessed, self-absorbed person like me do that? Because that's all I do is, I mean, I'm not much, but I am all I think about. I mean, you know, I just think about me, you know. I don't know what the, when you guys wake up in the morning, I wake up just thinking about me, thinking about my life, thinking about my stuff, thinking about me, me, me. How is a self-obsessed, self-focused, self-consumed person like me going to possibly make my life none of my business? I can't. So in the second line of the prayer, I asked God, I said, God, please relieve me of the bondage of self, the bondage. I am shackled to this self-obsession. I can't stop thinking about me. I remember the first time I really got it that I was self-centered. I was sitting there in my house and thinking, my God, that's it. That's been my problem all my life. It's everything. It's resentments. It's fears. It's relationships. It's work. It's self-centeredness is the deal. I thought to myself, well, thank God I found that out. I'm just not going to be that way anymore. I am shackled to that. I can't stop doing it. So I beg God. I said, relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. Because God, if you don't do that, how am I possibly going to make my life none of my business? I can't. And then I was in my 11th year of sobriety, and I'm taking a new guy through a third step. And he told me what the last line meant. And I'd been saying that prayer every day of my sobriety at that time for probably almost 11 years. And I didn't get it. The last, we're talking about the prayer. The last line, it says, take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. And the new guy says to me, he says, let me get this straight. We're going to try to make our life none of our business. We're going to ask God to relieve us of the bondage of self. We're going to do all this so we can help other people. And I went, oh yeah, of course, I knew that. I didn't know that. I was saying that prayer. How can you say a prayer 365 days of the year for almost 11 years and not get it? I don't know. But until he told me that, I didn't get it. That the whole, I'm doing all this just so I can help other people. See, if I'd have written that third step prayer, I wouldn't have wrote, take away my difficulties so victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. I'd say, take away my difficulties so everybody's going to realize how wonderful I am. Or take away my difficulties so I'll be happy. Let's take away my difficulties so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help. And I've come to believe with everything in me that I am a self-obsessed, self-centered person. And the program of recovery for a guy like me in Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program. It's a program of self-abandonment. That I show up in the detoxes and the jails, and I stick my hand out to the new guys, and I spend time with the guys I sponsor, and I listen to people on the phone that call me up at 3 o'clock in the morning because they can't sleep and wanted to know if I was sleeping. Were you up? Did I wake you? No, I had to get up and answer the phone anyway. I do all this stuff because while I'm trying to concern myself with you, I'm not worried about me. And when I'm not worried about me and I'm not living my life wrapped up in me and my problems at work and business and all the other stuff, God seems to be able to do wonderful things in my life. God has always, always been there for me in direct proportion to how much I leave my life alone. In direct proportion. And I've hurt myself in sobriety several times, and it's always been as a result of my self-will. My trying to make things happen and fix things. And when he said, you know the worst thing an alcoholic ever says to himself? Yeah, but it's the principle of the thing. They can't do that to me. Oh. I might as well put a gun to my head. I mean, just... And if I can just leave my life alone and leave it in God's hands and go help his kids, then great things happen to me. I made a commitment in early sobriety to do a minimum of 2 hospital institution meetings a week. Lately, the last year or so, I've been doing 3. I go to a men's halfway house Monday nights for a step workshop. I go to do a meeting in detox Tuesdays and Thursdays. And... It is the foundation of my recovery. I run my mouth a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I get asked to do this. And this is not that I don't like doing this. It's fun, and I guess it serves a purpose. But really, I got to tell you, really, where my heart is in those detoxes. It's with those new guys in their first 3 or 4 days of sobriety. Because there's something that's very magical that happens to me when I show up in those places, and I show up with the attitude of, I ask God, who can I help here? And I go there. And I can walk. I've walked into that meeting at noon sometimes down at that detox, and just been consumed with fear, because something's going wrong at business. Somebody's stealing from me or something. You know, just the problems that you run into when you're in business. And I'll go in there and I'll see some guy in there that's maybe 15 years sober that just had a relapse. And I'll listen to him. And I got to tell you, my friend Billy here says something that's one of the most profound things I ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous. He says that if I have the same disease that you have, what can happen to you can happen to me. And I'm not immune. I think I'm better than those guys? I'm not better than them. I do certain things every day that guarantee that I don't have a bed in that detox. That's all. And I tell you, there's rarely a week that goes by that I don't see somebody in that detox that has had long-term sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous and drank again. And a lot of those people at one time had excellent recovery, sponsored people, did all this stuff, were on committees. And I'll tell you a phenomenon I've observed, and I've observed this 1,000 times. We get sober and we have a whole, or the heat's on us, our life's a mess. We have a whole lot of alcoholism. I mean, we have so much alcoholism, we go to a meeting at least once a day. We talk to our sponsor. We stick our hand out to new people. We take commitments. We do all this stuff. 3 years sober, got some money in the bank, got a new car, got a relationship. Now, I'm not quite as alcoholic as I was when I was a year sober. I go to 4 or 5 meetings a week. And I talk to the newcomers once in a while. 5 years sober, 10 years sober, not very alcoholic at all. Come get a birthday cake once in a while. Go to a meeting, see my friends occasionally. And what happens is we start moving from alcoholism into alcoholism. And I believe with everything in me that recovery from this disease and the maintenance of that recovery is not in what I think, it's not in what I feel, it's not in not drinking and cleaning up your act, it's not in any of that stuff. It is in my feet. It is in the things that I do every day, every single day. Because I'll tell you, I have a healthy respect for this disease. Billy goes with me down to these detoxes, and Dick a lot. We see stuff down there that you don't see in normal Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Because if a guy is 15 or 20 or 25 years sober and he drinks again, he won't make it back into mainstream AA. He never makes it back in that far. He dies going in and out of missions and stuff. And that just scares the hell out of me. And it keeps my fire lit. It keeps me showing up for my commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous. It keeps me picking up the phone in the middle of the night. It keeps me going out and talking to some new guy or staying an hour after a meeting because some guy's having problems with a relationship. If you ever worked with a newcomer having problems with a relationship, it's like if they're, and I've did this myself. I've been there. I'm not saying anything. I haven't been there. That's the most self-obsessed time of our lives. It's like, it's like you go up to some guy that's having problems with his girlfriend and you say, Jim, I just found out I have terminal cancer and I got 3 weeks to live. Did you know what she said to me last night? And I keep showing up and trying to be there for somebody else because that's what a guy like me has to do. And I don't know that everybody in AA has to do that. I think only those of us that really have a problem with self-centeredness have to be there for other people. And if you don't have a problem with that, you probably don't have to do that. But I just think a lot about myself. I worry a lot about myself. I just really like to... matter of fact, most people interfere with my thinking about me. It's really kind of inconvenient. I want to tell you a story, and I want to shut up. This isn't original. I heard it,
18, 19, 20 years ago, somewhere along the line, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a Sunday afternoon. Guy's got the day off. He's sitting in his easy chair, reading the newspaper. Comfortable. He's got a six-year-old daughter. She comes over. She says, "Daddy, please play with me." He says, "Ah, sweetheart. Not now. I want to read the paper." He says, "Daddy, please play with me." And he looks in the paper, and there's an ad in there for an airlines. And it's a map of the world that shows where all these planes fly. And he gets an idea. He tears it out of the newspaper. He tears up this map of the world into little pieces, grabs a roll of scotch tape, and he says, "Sweetheart, here's a puzzle. It's a map of the world. Take it into your bedroom and put it together. And if you can put it together, bring it back, and I'll play with you for the rest of the day." She's all excited. She runs off into her bedroom. He sits back in his chair. He figures he's off the hook. She's 6 years old. She don't have a shot. 10 minutes later, she brings it back, and it's taped together perfectly. And he goes, "My God, sweetheart, how did you do that?" She says, "It was easy, Daddy. On the back was a picture of a man, and when I put the man together, the world just kind of fell into place." And if you're new, I encourage you with everything in me to get a sponsor in a home group and to start following these old-timers around in Alcoholics Anonymous and get into the process that's outlined in this book, precisely how it's outlined in this book, and you will observe the most incredible thing you've ever seen. A miracle to this day astounds me. A world that I never fit in, never belonged in, that I was constantly at odds with, has become a very, very nice place to live. Thank you. All right.